Good morning. It's so good to be back and see all of you here this morning. I hope you all had a wonderful New Year and a good Christmas and everything above and below and in between. To start off this morning, I just want to kind of recap where we've been, to kind of remind us where we're going, and then we'll talk about what we're going to do today. So where we've been was we are in week 6 of our study on Revelation. And we started, well, it's been about 7 or 8 weeks ago, so we've taken a couple weeks off. But we started on week 1, and we kind of laid an introduction about how we're going to approach this study. And we also diffused our first semantic bomb, which was literal versus figurative. And we said that we want to read Revelation not literally, not figuratively, but naturally. If he's using a symbol, let it be a symbol. If he's saying something literal, let it be literal. Read it naturally. Don't try to force it into this scheme, because language just doesn't work that way. And we gave all kinds of examples then. If you don't remember, go to the website and you can rewatch it, because they're all on there. The second week, we diffused some more semantic bombs. We talked about, are we living in the last days? And we looked at the Bible and we found that the Bible tells us that the last days is referring to between the first coming of Christ and the second coming of Christ. And as a result, we are living in the last days, and we have been for 2,000 years. The third question that we dealt with was, what is prophecy? And we found the Bible again tell us that it's not just prediction. But what prophecy is a revelation about who God is, what God desires, and what God demands from us. So then came week 3, and we started on dealing with the 6 elements of context. We have context is how we want to read the Bible, because if you take things out of context, you can do whatever you want. And we started the first week dealing with genre, and we saw that Revelation has 3 genres. The first one is the epistolary genre, which is a fancy word for a letter. Exactly, a letter. It is a letter. It is also a prophetic genre, which is something that describes who God is, what he desires, and what he demands from us. And the third genre we found was apocalyptic literature. That $50 word, $25 word, however much you're willing to give for it. Apocalyptic literature, which is heavily laden with symbolism. That right there kind of laid the foundation of how we are supposed to look at Revelation. What questions are we supposed to ask? Because it matters what section in the newspaper you're in. Remember that. So the genre we established is those 3. Then we went on the second element of the 6 elements of context and talked about the historical context. What was going on at the time Revelation was written? Who was it written to, and what were they going through? And we found that you could sum up that whole thing with the word conflict. It was a group of Christians in the middle of extreme conflict. Then last week, or 2 weeks ago, we talked about the 3rd and the 4th elements of context, and those were symbols and the sources of the symbols. We talked about Revelation because of the genre and other factors. It's heavily laden with symbolism. And so when you come to different things like numbers, what do we do with numbers? We don't measure them, we weigh them, exactly, because with numbers, when you weigh them in a symbolic context, the meaning comes out more. We'll talk about that actually more today. But then we talked about the sources. The sources of the symbols. Revelation has 404 verses and over 500 allusions to the Old Testament. If you don't know Revelation, if it confuses you, if your mind is boggled by it, it's probably because you don't know your Old Testament. Because John used the Old Testament to develop this tapestry, this beautiful picture that he's given to the Christians that are in conflict in Asia Minor, first century, at the end of the reign of Domitian, 95-96, and all that kind of sums up where we come to today. We're dealing with the 5th element today of context, and next week we will deal with element number 6. And element number 6 is application. And the week after that, I want to end our series the way that John ends his book, and we're going to have a whole day on heaven. Just talking about what heaven will be, what we will look like, who will be there, all of the above. But this week, we're talking about element number 5. And element number 5 is structure. And I'm just going to be flat out honest with you. This is hard. This is going to be hard. So I'm going to challenge you right off the front to just get ready to buckle down, to really concentrate hard when we're going through this, because it's going to be totally counterintuitive to what you're normally used to. And that'll become more clear once we get going. But first, what I want to do is I want to talk to you about your homework. Those of you that did it, I really want to hear from you. I want to hear the different things that you struggled with. I want to hear the different things that you really got. I want to hear the parts that were hard, the parts that were easy. Maybe you noticed something new when you were outlining the text. For those of you that don't know, the homework was they were supposed to read Revelation 6 through 20 and make an outline of Revelation chapter 6 through Revelation chapter 20. And I want to hear what happened. I may end up finding out that no one did it, and that would be something that would tell me something about the assignment. But just go ahead, either yell it out or raise your hand or whatever. Oh my. A lot of homework being done out there, right? Well, maybe you're too shy, and so I'll go ahead and give you an idea of what you would have found if you did it, or if I'm vocalizing some of you that did it and just don't want to say it. When you try to outline Revelation, it is absolutely, virtually impossible. It is so difficult. I mean, you'll have your Roman numeral 1, and then you'll have your capital A, and you'll get to going, and you get to chapter 6, and you're like, okay, this is the 6th, okay, you have seals, no problem. You get to the 6th seal, and you're waiting for the 7th seal, but it doesn't come for another chapter and a half. The 7th seal doesn't come to chapter 8, so then the question becomes, how do I then put in the outline chapter 7? And then finally you get to the 7th seal and you're like, okay, we're doing good now. And then you go into the 7 trumpets. And you get to the 6th trumpet and what happens? It's at the end of chapter 9 and chapter 10 and 11. You finally get to the 7th trumpet at the end of chapter 11, but you have all this chapter in the middle that has nothing to do with the trumpets. And then you're thinking, okay, fine, we're done with the trumpets. And then you get to chapter 12 and chapter 12 has nothing to do with the trumpets or the seals. It's totally different. So then you go chapter 12, 13, and 14. You're like, okay, those make sense together. Then you come to chapter 15, and it's kind of an introduction to the bowls in chapter 16. And then you have to start over with the problem again. And then you get to chapter 17, and it seems to be something totally separate from that. Chapter 17 and 18 seem like they go together. But then you get to chapter 19, and it starts something totally different again. And the same thing happens in chapter 20. And then finally you get to 21 and 22, which seem to make sense because that's new heavens and the new earth. That's what happens when you outline Revelation chapter 6 through 20, or if you go to 22. It is confusing. And when you try to plot it out the way we plot it out, it becomes almost impossible. And the reason why is because Revelation is an unfamiliar organization of thoughts. Have any of you ever seen... first of all, let me talk about that statement real quick. It is not unfamiliar thoughts. The thoughts are going to be very familiar. But it's an unfamiliar organization of those thoughts. The structure of it's weird. Have any of you ever seen the movie Memento? If you don't want to raise your hand, that's fine. I'll tell you. First of all, I'll tell you, I really wouldn't suggest go see it because, number one, it's not necessarily edifying. And number two, it is weird. You start off the movie and you're at the end of the movie. And you watch the ending of it and then it backs up like 5 or 10 minutes. Then you watch those 5 minutes and then you watch the ending again. And then you go back another 5 minutes. Then you watch all the way to the end and you back. And it does this throughout the whole movie. And finally, by the end of the movie, you watch the last segment and everything makes sense. But the whole time you're going through it, you're just going, what is going on? I don't understand what's going on. Frankly, for me, I fell asleep the first 2 times I tried to watch it because I was so bored. Why? Because it was an unfamiliar organization of thoughts. That's not normally the way we do things. We don't usually start at the end. Have any of you ever seen the movie Crash? That movie's a disturbing movie. And it really will kick you in the face about prejudice and racism. It really will. But that movie is an unfamiliar organization of thoughts as well. Because you start off at an event. And it's at the end. It's a crash. And what happens is you start getting introduced to the characters. And then the story moves back. And then you go forward for about 15 minutes from one character's perspective, and then it moves back again. And you go from another perspective of another character, and then it moves back again, and then another character, until all the characters finally merge, their stories merge at the event you very first saw, at the crash scene. And all of the character stories give this tension that challenges you specifically in the area of racism and prejudice. But it's kind of hard to follow at times. Why? Because that's not normal. It's an unfamiliar organization of thought. Have any of you, are any of you obsessed or have watched maybe once the TV show Lost? Yeah, I mean, I tell you what, I'm not a Lost guy. I don't watch it very much. Or actually, I refuse to watch it because I don't want to get hooked on a show. I can't. I just don't have time to get hooked on another show. I have The Office is what I usually lean towards. So that's enough show for me. Anyway, Lost is kind of like this. You have this event.
this crash, this airplane crash, and you have like 50 characters. And throughout the series, you'll go back into the character before the crash scene, before the moment that everybody's gone together. And it'll kind of lead, show their story of how they get to where they're at. And the whole story is about why are they there, how did they get there, and what's the purpose of them being there. The point is, though, the show is lost. The reason why people like it or really don't like it is because it's an unfamiliar organization of thoughts. Revelation is an unfamiliar organization of thoughts. And if you go in thinking it's going to move one way and it's moving another way, it becomes very confusing. Now, why? Why? Why did John not just make it easy? You know? Why didn't he just make it so simple that everybody could get it? Well, he did. Let me explain. You are a Westerner. Does that shock anyone? You're an American, most of you. You're a Westerner, so when you come to literature, when you come to conversations, when you come to anything, you're going to think like a Westerner. And Westerners think linearly. We think in a line, straight progressing line. A, the event A moves to event B to C to D, on and on until the end. It moves linearly, in a line. And when we come to Revelation, we expect it to do the same thing. We expect it to be chronologically in order the way that we think. The problem is, John was not a Westerner. He was a Jew. And Jews don't think linearly like we do. They think cyclically. They think in circles. They think in revolutions. Let me explain. There is a Jewish, very, very popular Jewish practice. It's called a chiasm. And what it is, it's in literature, and what they'll do is their main point will be point D. It'll be right over here. It'll be point D. And what they'll do is they'll start at point A, and then they'll move to point B, move to point C, and then they finally get to their main point, point D. But that's only at the middle of the message. Then they will talk about point D from another angle. Then they'll talk about point C from another angle. Then they'll talk about point B from another angle. And then they'll start talking about point A from another angle. Why do they do that? Because watch this. If you start at point A, and then you hit point B, point C, and then hit point D at the middle of your message, and then you come back up to point C, point B, point A, you've gone a complete circle. They think cyclically. The Jews are really enthralled by the question, we know how God has moved in the past, how is he cyclically moving in the present? How has he moved cyclically through the past? That's why you'll see a lot of times in Matthew, the gospel saying, when Jesus did this, it was fulfilled like it was said in the Old Testament. And he'll say, out of Egypt I called my son. And you go back and you read it in the context of the Old Testament, you're like, that's not what it was talking about. And we think, oh, he got it wrong. That prophecy really wasn't fulfilled out of Egypt in Jesus. You don't understand what Matthew's doing. He's thinking cyclically. He's saying what God did then, he's doing again now. Why? Because God's always moving through history. He's always moving through history, and you can tell because it looks a lot like. Revelation was not written by a Westerner moving linearly. It was written by a Jew moving cyclically. In literature, we call these two different perspectives by two different names. We call the Westerner linear way progression, chronological progression. That makes sense, right? Move from point A to point B. It really makes sense because that's the way we think. We call this cyclical thinking, the Jews, recapitulation. Now, you thought apocalyptic literature was a $25 word. Well, this one's worth $50. Recapitulation. Say it with me. Recapitulation. What in the world does that mean? It's a big fancy word and it shouldn't scare you because have you ever heard in a news story or in a sports report, somebody will say, okay, let's recap. Recap is an abbreviated way of saying the word recapitulation. It's the same thing. Now, what do they do in a recap? They will tell you the exact same event, the exact same thing they just told you, but they'll do it from a little bit of a different angle with a little bit of a different purpose. The different angle is much shorter. And their purpose is brevity. Why? Because they've already told you. And they want to tell you again. They want to give you the main points. They don't want to get bogged down on the details. They're going to recap everything. Recapitulation functions similar. As a matter of fact, the definition of recapitulation is this. In literature, recapitulation is the retelling of the same events from a different perspective with a different purpose, oftentimes involving intensification. Let me say that again. Recapitulation is retelling the exact same events, but from a different perspective. And the reason why there's a different perspective is because there's a different purpose in saying the same events. And oftentimes in literature, it involves intensification because the author is still going somewhere, even though he's telling the same things from a different perspective with a different purpose. I am suggesting that the book of Revelation was written by a Jew and like a Jew. Specifically, the book of Revelation was written recapitulating. It's written cyclically. Now, the first question that somebody should ask in order to challenge what I've just said is this. Do we have any other evidence of any other piece of literature, especially biblical literature, that does this? Because you could just be pulling some academic word out of your hat and just pulling it on Revelation so you could push your own agenda. Let's look. As a matter of fact, you don't have to look very far in your Bibles. If you look in Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2, the first two chapters of the Bible are recapitulating. What is Genesis chapter 1? What's the whole purpose and point of Genesis chapter 1? Creation, to tell us how God created the earth. But what happens in Genesis chapter 2, about three or four verses in? He tells the creation story again. He tells the first 5 days real quick. God created everything, everything was there, and then he gets to the sixth day. Why is the sixth day important to him in chapter 2? What's that? Who was created then? Man. You see, he tells the creation story again at the beginning of chapter 2 so that he can get to the sixth day. And once he gets to the sixth day, he slows way down. He says, God created man out of the dust. He formed him with his own hands and he breathed life into him. And whenever man had life, then God brought him all of the animals and he named all of them. And every name he gave them, that was the name the animal was called. And Adam looked at all the animals and he said, there was no one suitable to be my helper. And so God put him to sleep. And while he slept, he took out a rib and he formed woman. And Adam wakes up and he says, whoa, man, that's a suitable helper. That makes sense, God. And man was created. But it's interesting because in chapter 1, that whole story is summed up in verse 26, which says, God made man in his own image, male and female, he made them. That's it. That's all it says. It does talk about, you know, then he tells them, you know, to multiply and fulfill and fill the whole earth. But it does not go into the story about the way Adam was formed. It doesn't go into the story about the way Eve was formed. It doesn't have anything to do with the other animals. It is quick. Why? Because chapter 1 has a different purpose. The purpose of chapter 1 is to tell us the way in which God created everything. Chapter 2, though, says the same thing, especially in the first 5-6 verses. Everything was created. Then it says day 6. Chapter 2's creation account is different because it wants to focus not just on what God has done, but on the relationship that's going to set the stage for the rest of the Bible. So the very first two chapters of the Bible, we have recapitulation. The whole creation account's done, you get to day 7, and what does the author do in chapter 2? He says, let's back up and let's say it all again. Day 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then he just kind of leaves off 7. Do you see what's happening? Let me give you another example. This time we won't go in the Pentateuch. We'll go to the prophetic literature. We've already talked about this one. Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 2, you have the vision of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. He has this vision and he tells his wise men, you need to not only tell me what the vision means, but you need to tell me what the vision is. And Daniel's the only one that's able to do this. And Daniel says, the vision you saw was of a statue. And the statue had a head of gold. It had a chest and arms of silver, it had a belly and thighs of bronze, and it had legs and feet that were made of iron and clay mixed. And he says, and what this stands for is the next four kingdoms that are going to come about over the next 1,000 years. Then in Daniel chapter 7, what do we have? Daniel has a vision, not Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel. And Daniel sees these four beasts. And they each one of them are a little different, but each one of them are vicious, and they intensify as they go. And Daniel asked the angel, what is this? And basically the angel says, it's the same thing Nebuchadnezzar saw. It's the four kingdoms that are going to be coming out over the next 1,000 years. So here's my question. Why say it 2 times? Why recapitulate it? Because it's from a different perspective with a different purpose. What is the purpose? Daniel chapter 2 describes the way in which humanity looks at empires. We look at empires as something to be treasured, like gold and silver and bronze and iron. It's something that we honor and revere. Daniel chapter 7 is from God's perspective, the way that he looks at empires as beasts that devour what is ever in their path in order for them to grow larger. And there's a message in that, and I'll let you connect the dots, because the point is, even in prophetic literature, we have recapitulation. And I can give you more examples. Genesis chapter 41 with the Pharaoh and his two dreams. The two different dreams, but it has the same events being retold twice with a different purpose each time. Or Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39, the battle of Gog and Magog. You have the battle in 38 that seems like it totally ends, and then it starts back over in 39 and tells it from a different angle. But I know what you're thinking. You're only talking about the Old Testament, which would make sense in the context of Revelation since he relied on it. But let's just act like if we only have the Old Testament that has recapitulation, maybe it's not something that was going on in the New Testament. But all you have to do is look at the first four books of the New Testament. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John recapitulate each other. They're each telling the same events. The life, death, resurrection of Jesus. But they tell it from a different perspective with a different purpose. Every one of them. Matthew, what's his perspective? He's one of the disciples, but he's a tax collector. He is not one of those that in society would be called a part of the in crowd. He's an outsider. And his perspective is a little different. Then you have Mark, who wasn't even a direct disciple of Jesus. Matter of fact, John Mark, we know, was a part of Paul's situation. Remember how Paul and Barnabas, they had a little bit of a tiff over John Mark? Church history tells us the way that John Mark wrote his gospel was that he was a disciple of Peter. And the gospel of Mark is from the sermons of Peter that John Mark listened to. Then we have Luke, who was a Gentile, total Gentile. And he was probably a physician, and he was a companion of Paul, so he has a totally different perspective than the first two. And then you have John, the writer of Revelation, who was not only a disciple of Jesus, he was one of the inner three, and by society standards in the Jewish world, he would have been a part of the very much in crowd. So you have each of the different events, the exact same events, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus, being told by four completely different perspectives, and the four purposes, now listen to this, you can tell the purpose of the gospel by reading the genealogy. You know those list of names that you just skip over because, oh my word, this guy married this guy, and this had the son of this guy, and the son. Who cares? Oh, in the ancient world, they cared. If you read the genealogies, you can tell what the purpose of every one of the gospels is. Let me tell you. The genealogy of Matthew goes back to whom? King David. The whole point of Matthew's gospel is to show not just that Jesus is a king, but that he is the fulfillment of all that the Old Testament was looking for. The throne that reigns forever, the King David's throne. That's his whole point. And then you have Mark. Who's his genealogy go back to? That's a trick question. He doesn't have a genealogy. If you'd ask a person in the first century who doesn't have a genealogy or who doesn't care about genealogies, you know who they would say? Slaves. Servants. And Mark chapter 10 seems to ring in my ears. For the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Mark's point is to show Jesus is a servant. And then you go to Luke, and where does his genealogy go back to? Adam. What would his point be? Jesus is a man. Don't miss the fact that while his sacrifice is magnificent, he was really a man, Hebrews. He experienced all the trials and tribulations and temptations that you have experienced, and yet he was without sin. And then you have John. John's genealogy is one of the most beautiful things I think ever written. In the beginning was the Word. Right off the bat, if you hear the words in the beginning, what do you think of? It's interesting that the writer of the Gospel of John would go back to the Old Testament, right? When you think of Revelation. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. In the beginning was the Word. What does his genealogy go back to? He's saying Jesus is God. So you have four of the exact same events being told, life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, by four totally different people with four completely different purposes. Why? Because they are recapitulating. They are telling the same events from a different perspective with a different purpose. So yes, there is definitely biblical precedent for recapitulation. Why? Because we have a lot of Jews writing the books of our Bible. That's why. And they don't think linearly. They think cyclically. So how does this recapitulation reveal itself in the book of Revelation? It does it several different ways, but we're only going to have time to go over a couple of them. But after you go over the couple of them, you'll see how this is emerging. First of all, I want us to look at the way in which in Revelation we come to the end of the world all the stinking time. We're at the end of the world all the time. And the very first time that we can see coming to the end of the world is in Revelation chapter 6. Revelation chapter 6, verse 12. Revelation chapter 6, verse 12 is the sixth seal. The sixth seal is about to be broken. And this is what it says. Verse 12. Who's the I here? John. John watched as he, who is the he? The slain lamb of Revelation chapter 5. The one that is worthy to break open the scrolls. So I, John, watched as he, Jesus, the slain lamb, opened the sixth seal. There was a great earthquake. The sun turned black like sackcloth made of goat hair. The whole moon turned blood red. And the stars in the sky fell to the earth as late figs dropped from a fig tree when shaken by a strong wind. Okay, now here's my question. If I take that literally, okay, what would happen if a star fell to the earth? Totally destroyed. Scientifically, there is no way around it. You want to know why? Our earth has a diameter of 7,900 miles. Cut the earth in half, straight across, the way you measure it, 7,900 miles. One of the average smallest stars, the average of the smallest star, is 88,000 miles diameter. Our sun has an 860,000 mile diameter. If one star, 88,000 miles diameter, fell to the earth, 7,900 miles diameter, and it's a big ball of fire, it's a big ball of gas, what's going to happen? We're in trouble. And what does this say? The stars in the sky fell to the earth. Now, if I take that literally or figuratively, something cataclysmic has happened, and it kind of sounds like the end of the world. But let's just act like it's not, and let's keep reading. Verse 14, the sky receded like a scroll rolling up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. Okay, Al Gore has a whole bunch of people in a tizzy about this global warming thing. And what everybody's all freaking out about is these, you know, the ice caps melting only a little bit and raising the ocean level only by a couple of inches, which could be scientifically catastrophic, not only for the coastlines, but for the climate of the whole world. Now, whether or not you agree with that or not is neither here nor there. Listen to the point. If people are freaking out about that, and all of the islands are going to be removed from the earth here, what's going to happen to the climate and the makeup of the earth? Let's not even talk about the stars that have already fallen, okay? Let's just act like all of the islands move. How is that going to affect everything? What if we get rid of all the mountains too? You see the problem? It doesn't sound like you're going to say, and tomorrow it'll be sunny and warm. It just doesn't seem that way. But let's keep reading. Let's act like it's not the end of the world and keep reading. Verse 15. Then the kings of the earth, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to point out something. Every time I'm going to say a group of people, I'm going to put up a finger. The kings of the earth, the princes, the generals, the rich, the mighty, the slave, and every free man. How many are there? What did we learn about seven last, or 2 weeks ago? It's a number of completion. He doesn't name just seven random groups of people. He's saying something. The complete group of people, and we're going to see in a moment, that is judged. The kings of the earth, the princes, the generals, the rich, the mighty, and every slave and every free man hid in caves and among the rocks of the mountains. They called to the mountains and the rocks, "Fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb." For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand? Now, whenever you hear the great day of the wrath of God and of the Lamb, biblically, what is that referring to? The end of everything. Judgment. The great day of judgment has come, and the question is, who can stand? And we'll deal with the question later. The point I'm trying to make is time and time again here in these five verses, the world is destroyed. The world is at the end. The sixth seal, broken, takes care of all the stars fallen, all the islands and mountains moving, and the great day of wrath has come. What collectively is that saying? It's the end. Here's the problem. We still have 16 more chapters to go in Revelation. If I'm reading this linearly, chronologically, I have a major problem. Because I am only at the sixth seal. I still have seven more trumpets. I still have seven more bowls. I still have Armageddon. But the world's over in chapter six. But if you're thinking cyclically, all this makes sense. As a matter of fact, what's fascinating is that the end of the trumpets and the end of the bowls also come to the end of the world. Turn to Revelation chapter 11, verse 15. I have a little heading at the top of my NIV, and it says, the seventh trumpet. Verse 15 says, the seventh angel sounded his trumpet, and there were loud voices in heaven which said, the kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he will reign forever and ever. And the 24 elders who were seated on their thrones before God fell on their faces and worshiped God, saying, listen to what the elders say. We give thanks to you, Lord God Almighty, the one who is and who was. What did they leave out? Who is to come. Why? Because there is no future of God coming at this point. He's there. It's not the one who is and who was and who is to come. It's the one who is and who was, who is here now. There is no future for these elders. There is no future coming of Christ. There is no future coming of God because he's there in the elders' vision. Listen to what they say. We give thanks to you, Lord God Almighty, the one who is and who was, because you have taken your great power and have begun to reign. The nations were angry, and your wrath has come. The time has come for judging the dead and for rewarding your servants, the prophets, and your saints, and those who reverence your name, both small and great, and for destroying those who destroy the earth. What does that sound like? The end of the world. The great day of your judgment has come for judging the dead and for rewarding the good. What is that? That's what happens. John 5, 28 through 29. That's what happens when Christ comes back. It's the end. The world's done. But the problem is, we still have 11 more chapters to go in the book of Revelation. Turn to Revelation chapter 16. Revelation chapter 16, verse 17. This is the end of the bowls. The seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air, and out of the temple came a loud voice from the throne saying, it is done. Then there came flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, a severe earthquake. No earthquake like it has ever occurred since man has been on earth. So tremendous was the quake. The great city split into three parts, and the cities of the nations collapsed. God remembered Babylon the Great and gave her the cup filled with the wine of the fury of his wrath. Verse 20 sounds familiar. Every island fled away, and the mountains could not be found. What does that sound like? Sounds like the sixth seal, doesn't it? And if you take away every island and you remove every mountain, what happens to the earth? It's done. Scientifically, it is over. You cannot remove all the islands and think there will be no effect on the earth. If we're worried about the ice caps melting a couple inches and killing all the inhabitants of the earth, then if you remove one island, there's going to be an issue. You move all the islands, there's a major issue. So once again, here at the end of the bowls, what happens? The world's done. It's over. And then you have Revelation chapter 19, verses 11 through 21. And I'm not going to read those. I'm going to summarize it. You have the divine warrior coming in. And he's, it looks like this picture. He's wearing a white robe that's dipped in blood. He's riding a white horse. And gathered together is all of the evil of the world. And leading them is the beast and the false prophet. And what happens? The divine warrior takes the beast and the false prophet, and it says he throws them alive, and emphasizes they're alive, into the lake of fire. And then in verse 21, the sword of the mouth, out of the mouth of the divine warrior, wipes out all of the evil that have gathered for war. And earlier we saw that it was all of the evil in the world. What does that sound like? The great day of judgment. Everything's done. Jesus' second coming has come back. He has made the wrongs right. And now it's time to move on with eternity. But it's weird. Because then in Revelation chapter 20, well, this is weird. It says that Satan's bound to keep him from deceiving the nations. The word nation in Revelation and throughout Jewish literature refers to the evil ones. It's the word ethnos in Greek, and a lot of times it'd be translated Gentiles, those that are outside of the fold of God. Satan is kept from deceiving the nations. Here's my question. Who gathered for the war against the Lamb just a couple verses earlier? All of the evil of the world. And what happened to them? They were slain by the sword that came out of the mouth of the warrior, which is the word of God. Because there is no battle. Anyway, my question is then, who does Satan have to deceive? I mean, if they've all been wiped out, oh, they've all been killed, so now lock him up so that he doesn't deceive the ones that are dead. A lot of times what people have to do is they have to figure out a way to get evil people to come alive during the millennium. And they'll come up with these weird ideas of the way to get evil people back into the millennium. But it's not in the text. Matter of fact, what ends up happening at the end of the 1,000 years is Satan gathers together all of the army and they get ready for war. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? He gathers together for war. What do? They go to make war. And is there a war? There's no war again. What happens is they surround the people of God and then fire comes down and devours them. And then in verse 11, we have the great white throne judgment where the evil come forward and they're judged. What's that sound like? The end of the world. And then in Revelation chapter 21, 1 and following, it says, I saw a new Jerusalem. And the new Jerusalem comes down and there's a new heavens and a new earth. And then it starts talking about the evil that are then thrown into the lake of fire. And it says they will experience the second death. It sounds like he's talking about the end again. This is at least 6 times in the book of Revelation. We come to the end, and it all starts in Revelation chapter 6 with the sixth seal, with all the stars falling, with the islands being removed, and with the great day of the wrath coming. Linearly, this makes absolutely no sense. Cyclically, this is beautiful. Why? Because the seals, trumpets, and bowls make sense cyclically, but they're absolutely ridiculous if you look at it linearly. Let's take a look at it. There are some significant... I want to put down my Bible because I'm going to use that in a minute. There are some significant similarities between the seals, trumpets, and bowls. First of all, there's 7 of each. You have 7 seals, 7 trumpets, 7 bowls. Why the number 7? Completion. Completion. Second is, each of them deals with judgments. They all deal with judgment. Every one of them. All the series. There are a couple of them of the specific, like the fifth seal is not a judgment. It's the martyrs underneath the altar asking God, when will you end everything? And God says, wait until more of you die. Okay? And then what happens? The next seal is broken and he ends everything. He could have looked at him and just said, wait a verse. Okay? But he didn't. Each of them deals with judgments. Another similarity, now listen to this very closely, is that between the 6th and the 7th of each of the elements, of the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls, there is an interlude. There is a press pause, let me tell you something. In between the 6th and the 7th seal, you have a whole chapter, chapter 7. That you get to the end of the 6th seal, and then they ask who can stand, and then he starts talking about these 144,000, this great multitude. And then in 8:1, then he says, the 7th seal was broken and there was silence in heaven for a half an hour. There's an interlude between the 6th and the 7th. 6th and the 7th trumpet, the 7th or the 6th trumpet is blown at the end of chapter 9. And then you have chapter 10 all the way up to verse 11, 15 before you get the seventh trumpet. You have a chapter and a half interlude. And then the bowls. This is really interesting. The bowls, you have the sixth bowl poured out in verse 12. And it starts describing what happens. And you get to verse 15, and it is just random out of the blue. In my Bible, all of a sudden, it's red letters. I mean, it's just, behold, I am coming like a thief. You're like, well, what is going on there? It's an interlude. In between the sixth and the seventh of all three of these series of judgments, there's an interlude. And here's why that's important. The message for each recapitulation is in the interlude. John is stopping the judgments. He's stopping the discourse. He's saying, don't miss the point. I'm telling you something. Each of these are going to end the world. Every single one of them, the world is destroyed. But every single one of them is going to have a specific point to tell to the Christians of the first century. And here's what the point is. Revelation chapter 6, verse 15 through 17, we've already read. It's where you have the kings and they hide underneath in the caves and they're calling on the rocks to fall on them. Why? Because the great day of the wrath of the Lamb has come. Now listen to what he says. Verse 17. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand? That is a question that would be ringing in the ears of the Christians. Who can stand? And chapter 7 says, this is who can stand. Who can stand? I'll give you three groups that can stand. And this is what he does. Chapter 7, verses 1 through 8 is the mystical 144,000 which the Jehovah's Witnesses blow. They just mess it up totally. They say the 144,000 is this group of people that will be in heaven with God. It's a special group that will be in heaven with God while the rest of us are on a different earth, even if we make it. You have to be a JW to make it. But the 144,000 with heaven. The problem is in chapter 7, the 144,000 are on earth. Read the first four verses. I mean, everywhere you look in verse 1, it says, the winds of the earth to prevent anyone from blowing, on the land or on the sea or on the tree. Then I saw another angel. You go down into verse 3. Do not harm the land or the sea or the trees until we put a seal on the foreheads of the servants of our God. Where are the servants of our God? On earth! And then he says, the number of them was cried out. And it was 144,000. What do we do with numbers in Revelation? We don't measure them, we weigh them. Now let's break down 144,000. 144 is what times what? 12 times 12. Where in the Bible do you see the number 12? Significant number 12. Okay, I heard what?
Disciples.
What else? Tribes. Now this is interesting. Do you think it was on accident that Jesus chose 12 disciples? Oh, no, no, no. He's saying something quite profound. I am the true Israel, Jesus says. And this is the new Israel. This is the fulfillment of what God was building up to in the Old Testament. 12, usually as a number throughout Jewish literature and our Bible, is part of that. That stands for the completion, like number 7, but it's usually attached to the people of God. The complete number for the people of God. Completion of the people of God. And what we have here in 144,000 is this. 12 tribes, and there's 12,000 in each of them. 12, complete number of the people of God, times 12, complete number of the people of God, stands for the complete number of the people of God. It's the number of the people of God that's very much complete. Times 1,000. Now, what's 1,000? 1,000 is a symbol for a really big number. Here's my point. Psalms. God is a God of a cattle on 1,000 hills. Does that mean when you get to hill 1,001, he's not the God of them? Because it's only 1,000. No. It's symbolic genre. What is he saying? God is the God of the cattle on all of the hills that you can look at, the biggest number of hills. 2 Peter chapter 3, it says, for God, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is like a day. Is Peter really trying to describe the way in which when we go through a 24-hour period, God's gone through 1,000 years? And when God goes through 1,000 years, well, it's only been a day down here. No, he's not describing the time relationship between the earth and heaven. What he's saying is, in the context of 2 Peter 3, he's saying, I know it seems like Jesus isn't coming back. But the reason why is because God wants all the people to get in. And for him to wait 1,000 years, for him, he's patient enough. Why? Because he loves those people so much. It doesn't matter if it's 1,000 years or a day. He just wants them all to come in. It doesn't matter if it's a big number or a small number. The point is, God wants them all to get in. You see how 1,000's being used? It's a really big number. The complete people of God times the complete people of God times a really big number stands for, symbolically, when I weigh it, the complete people of God that is just a magnificently large number on earth. 144,000 says this. Who can stand? God's people that are living on earth, which for John's audience would be them. See that? And then in verse 9, what happens? He says, I look and I saw a great multitude. And what are they doing? They are standing before the throne. Where are they? They're in heaven. And what are they doing? Standing. And what is the question that's been asked just a couple of verses earlier? Who can stand? The question then is, who is the great multitude? And as you read down through the hymns, the great multitude is revealed to be the people of God that have died and are now with him in his presence. But in verse 11, we see another group standing. It says, all of the angels were standing before the throne. Who can stand? The answer is this. God's people on earth, God's people in heaven, even the angels. All of them can be summed up as the servants of God. That's who can stand on the great day of the wrath of the Lamb. People that, whether they're dead or alive, whether they are human or whether they are angels, they are the ones that are serving God, that are worshiping God, that are praising and living for Jesus. They are the ones that can stand. The whole seals is summed up in this chapter. Who can stand the atrocity on the great day, whenever everything ends, who can stand? And John looks at me and he says, Christians, you are spiritually secure. You're not physically secure. Because remember, the fifth seal was the souls of the martyrs. And God says, more of you are going to die. You're not physically secure. You are spiritually secure. And then you have the trumpets. The trumpets, you have the sixth trumpet, blown at the end of chapter 9. And then chapter 10 comes. Chapter 10 is weird. You see this really big angel, and he's got one leg standing on the land and one leg in the water, and he gives this small scroll to John, and John eats it, and it's sweet in his mouth, but it's sour in his stomach. That kind of sounds like an Old Testament allusion. You can look that up on your own. But he gets this message, and then he says, go and prophesy this message you've received. And what we then find is we see this weird vision in chapter 11, where he measures this temple, and then these two witnesses come on the scene. These two witnesses, when they're described, it sounds an awful lot like this guy named Elijah and this guy named Moses. And for a Jew, that's quite significant. And you want to know why? It's because for a Jew, Elijah sums up all the prophets. And for a Jew, Moses sums up all the law. And a way of referring to the Old Testament is to say, the law and the prophets. All of the Old Testament is entailed in these two symbolic figures, which is probably why they were there at the Transfiguration. And it's also significant that whenever they bowed their heads, the disciples, whenever God says, Peter, shut up, this is my son, I love him, listen to him. And they look back up, and Jesus glowing in all of his brilliance, and who's gone? The law and the prophets. Why? Because they are summed up and fulfilled in the one figure that's still left standing at the Transfiguration, Jesus. So it's fascinating that we see these two witnesses, they look an awful lot like Elijah and Moses, but they also look an awful lot like Jesus. Their message, which is very powerful, obviously ticked off a lot of people because their message ends up getting them killed. They get killed, and what happens? They lay in the streets, and then after 3 days, 3.5 days, they're raised from the dead. Does that sound familiar? And then what happens when they're raised from the dead? They ascend into the heavens on a cloud. Does that sound familiar? And guess where they were killed? It says they were killed in the city that our Savior was murdered. They were killed in Jerusalem. Why two witnesses? Because every valid testimony in a court of law must be validated by 2 to 3 witnesses. And it's interesting because these two witnesses are also described as 2 olive branches and 2 lampstands. And Zechariah, in his prophecy in chapter 10, describes the Messiah in the way he describes him as two olive branches and two lampstands. This is what's being said here. In the trumpets, John is being told to tell them this message. Your job is to make your witness known. And it will lead probably to your suffering and more than likely to your death. But guess what? You're in good company. Because it kind of happened to our Savior. Your job as Christians, I don't care if what comes your way, is to witness, says the trumpets. And that's awful comforting hearing that after you know you're already spiritually secure, you know? The seals, they say, you're spiritually secure. And the trumpets say, since you're spiritually secure, your Lord has told you to do something. Go do it. And if you die, it's okay. Because just like Christ, you will be raised. And you will be in the presence of God. Then you have the bowls. The bowls interlude is much more succinct. It is in chapter 16, verse 15. But like the other two interludes, the bowl interlude is going to tell us what the message is to the Christians for all of the bowls. Because remember, recapitulation is telling the exact same things, destruction of the world. From a different perspective, seals, trumpets, bowls, for a different purpose. The purpose for the bowls is this. Verse 15, behold, I come like a thief. We've heard that in the scripture before, and who is the I? Jesus. And why does he say a thief? Because he's saying there's no map that points out when I'm coming. Just like there's no map that tells you when a thief is coming to your house. The thief just comes. Totally unexpected. Without any sort of notice, he's just there. Right? And Jesus says, like a thief, I'm coming. And he says what? Blessed is he who stays awake and keeps his clothes with him so that he may not go naked and be shamefully exposed. We've talked about this before. We'll talk about it more next week. Clothes in Revelation always demarcate someone's ethics. One of the churches in Asia Minor, it says, some of you are there and your clothes have been soiled. In Revelation 19:8, when it's describing the bride, it says, the bride is dressed in fine white linen, prepared for her husband. And then in parentheses, it says, fine linen stands for the righteous acts of the saints. Fine linen stands for the acts of the saints, the deeds that they do, the ethics that they live by. In Jesus, matter of fact, in Laodicea, it says, you guys say you're clothed, but I'm saying you're naked. Why? Because they're lukewarm. And Jesus is ready to vomit them out of his mouth. Clothing in Revelation indicates ethics. If you're naked, your ethics are shameful and evil. If you are clothed, purely clothed, non-soiled, your ethics are pure. And Jesus says in verse 15, behold, I'm coming like a thief. Blessed are those who are awake and who keep their clothing with them so that they'll be ready when he comes. The message of the bowls is this. Your ethics matter. If you piece these three recapitulations together, listen to the message that's being said. Christians in the first century, you are spiritually secure. Who can stand? You can stand. Therefore, the trumpets, you need to witness. Even if it means your death, you witness. And how do you witness? The bowls, you witness by what you do. And if you don't do something, then you're also witnessing for another kingdom and another master. This seems to make a lot more sense. Instead of trying to march through and figure out where are we on this roadmap of Revelation, linearly, like Westerners tend to do, I think it's more sufficient to look at it like a Jew. Why? Because it's not just the end of the world that presents problems for the linear perspective. It's not just the end of the world in chapter 6. What about Revelation chapter 12? We talked about this a couple weeks ago. Revelation chapter 12, you see this beautiful picture of this woman that is great with child. She's coming down, and there's a dragon there. The dragon's waiting there to devour the child that comes out of her. And we know the child is Jesus because it says, the child is the one who will rule the nations with an iron scepter. That is the Messiah. And what we talked about was what John is doing, it is he's pulling back the veil of the nativity scene. And he's saying there was a lot more going on there than just sheep and cattle in a barn. There was a cosmic struggle that was ensuing. And we came out victorious. Here's my question. The story of the nativity scene of Jesus in chapter 12, after the seals and the trumpets have already been broken and blown, how does that make sense linearly? Linearly, chronologically, you'd have to say then that the seals and the trumpets happened before Jesus was even born. If you're plotting out a roadmap, right? Do you see the problem? You honestly, you know, people that are arguing for progression, you know what they do with chapter 12? They ignore it. They skip over it. They don't mention it. Why? They don't know what to do with it. Because how can chronology make sense if it takes us back 2,000 years and we should have been talking about the end of the world all the way up until then? But cyclically, well, that makes perfect sense. You just got done talking about the two witnesses looking awful lot like Jesus when he died and rose from the dead and went up to ascend to heaven, and now you're going to start talking about his nativity scene. Chronologically, it may not make sense, but it makes perfect sense in the overall scheme of way Revelation is developing. What about Revelation 16:15? He says, behold, I'm coming like a thief. Jesus, you're not coming like a thief. I've got a roadmap of how you're coming. How can you tell me at the end of the sixth bowl that you're coming like a thief? I've already been able to trace where you're at. Like a thief. You're going to be here in 2-3 chapters. If you look at things linearly, Revelation is a mess. But if you look at things cyclically, it makes perfect sense. Why recapitulation? Number one, the people that were reading the book of Revelation would have been familiar with it. It would not have shocked them that things were recapitulating. Why? Because they think cyclically already. Number two, the benefit of recapitulation is that you can talk about the same topic, but you can hit different angles of it so that you get the overall message that's trying to be communicated. Number three, recapitulation hammers home the same core message. All three, the seals, trumpets, and bowls say this. If you are a devout follower of Jesus Christ and he is your Lord, stand firm. Period. Stand firm. Recapitulation. There's a saying by Jewish rabbis, and they say this. Repetition is the mother of all wisdom. And recapitulation hammers that home again and again and again and again. They understand their purpose by the time they get to chapter 22. Because they know that it doesn't matter what this world does to them, they have a better world that's promised for them. And as a matter of fact, they're more well-made for the world that's to come than they are for this one that they're living in. Your homework for next week is to read the book of Revelation without chapter verse divisions. You got that the first week. If you don't have it, I think there are copies out there. It's Revelation without chapter verse divisions. The reason why is because chapter verse divisions weren't added until the 12th century. And so this allows you to read it the way the letter would have been received by the first century Christians. Read it without chapter verse divisions, and I want you to write down every single time that there is a word of exhortation, Christ or somebody, John, commanding the people to do something, and every single time there is a word of comfort, of when Christ says, I know you're going through this, but take this to heart, or obey this. Every single time, and I want you to then look at your list and ask these questions. Are there certain areas of the letter where this is more concentrated? Where there are more exhortations concentrated? More comfort concentrated? And I want you to ask, how is it throughout the whole book of Revelation or just at the beginning and just at the end? And then that'll play into and lay the foundation for what we're going to do next week. And next week will be how do we apply the book of Revelation to us today? Until then, you guys are dismissed. God bless. And I can't wait to see you next week.